Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Pat Schlarbaum, and I'm here with our co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Ursula.
Hello.
And for today's weather, we've had some partly sunny opportunities with the high near 44. The winds will be abating. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low around 27, northeast winds at 6 to 9. Saturday, sunny with a high near 55. Light and variable wind becoming south, 5 to 10 miles per hour in the afternoon. And Saturday night, mostly clear with a low around 38. Breezy with a south wind at 13 to 16. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 69, but it will be somewhat windy, as high as 32 miles per hour. And it looks like we're moving into spring. We've had our moisture now. We've had our clap of thunder.
And what does the clap of thunder do?
I understand from the farmers that a clap of thunder is always necessary to get the remaining vestiges of frost to come out of the ground. Now, how those old sayings become old sayings, I'm not really sure. But.
And what about the worms?
Oh, and so with the frost diminished, then the worms are more active. So we are definitely moving towards spring.
Oh, I always heard that the clap of thunder woke the worms up.
It wakes them up, sure. It makes them active. Great. You know, this Saturday, there's going to be an eco fair at the Ames Community Center. That's in City Hall between 5th and 6th Avenue here in the west end of downtown Ames. Look for the Outdoor Alliance of Story County. This is a new organization that is getting together. It's another way to help the habitat in Story County. So look for those folks, Mike Metz and Linda Zalatel at the Outdoor Alliance of Story County.
And also, we want to announce that singer-songwriter Peter Mayer will be performing at the City Auditorium tomorrow night, which is Saturday, March 29th. If you listen regularly, you may have heard one of his songs. He is a favorite on Local Talk. So, again, that's Peter Mayer will be performing tomorrow night at City Auditorium at 7:30.
And now let's bring on a little phenology. Phenology is noting nature's happenings when they occur. The dates of the first woodland wildflower, hepaticas of spring, or the last osprey of autumn are written in a journal for future reference. Today's focus on phenology are American kestrels. Kestrels can be seen pairing up and looking to mate anytime soon. American kestrels are a small raptor about the size of a blue jay, called a sparrowhawk, but they are really falcons. Like all raptors, they have keen eyesight, talents for grasping their prey, and a beak for ripping and tearing. Prey items can be anything from mice to grasshoppers and dragonflies. Kestrels inhabit our roadways for foraging a specific mouse of the grasslands called meadow voles. Different from other raptors, males are colored with slate blue mixed into their brown feathers, and the females are all brown. This is a term called dimorphism, where the male is different in coloration than the female. Also, they nest in cavities or nest boxes, where most raptors make a nest platform. In 1984, American kestrels were not numerous and perilously close to becoming a threatened or even an endangered species. Ron Andrews was working for the Iowa DNR as a fur bearer specialist, and Ron is also a jogger, and he enjoyed seeing kestrels hovering into the wind, hunting the roadsides of Interstate 35 near Clear Lake, Iowa. Realizing kestrels had everything for their livelihood except a cavity to nest in, he gained the idea to go to the Iowa DOT and ask permission to place nest boxes for kestrels behind the directional signs along Interstate 35. The director of the Iowa DOT heard all the advantages and disadvantages of the nest box program and said, well, why not? And the American Kestrel Nest Box Program was initiated. My first job with the DNR in 1985 was to build 84 boxes for this project. Over the next few years, the Nest Box Program extended across Iowa from Minnesota to Missouri and to many other state highways. 12 other states around the nation started their kestrel nest box programs. And then over the years, Dan Varlin, an ISU grad student, received his PhD studying the kestrel survival. Approximately 45% of the boxes were used. They are quite prolific and average nearly 5 young per clutch per year. And after the young fledge, they have a tendency to hunt together, which is unique to only the other Harris hawks of western areas have that ability. Literally thousands of kestrels have fledged or flown successfully from their nest boxes lining our Iowa roadways. There has been a setback for American Kestrel Nest Box Program, but with adversity there are also opportunities. In the interest of safety, the Iowa DOT has discontinued our Kestrel Nest Box Partnership. The boxes along the interstate and state highways will be taken down as workers are involved with projects near the signs. Obviously, the nesting pairs will be good for this year's nesting season, but boxes will be available later this summer. If you'd like one, just let me know at 515-460-1815. That's 515-460-1815. Or plans are available for installing boxes along gravel roads or in your acreage. The boxes can also provide a necessary cavity for screech owls, especially around town. And that's our Focus on Phenology for late March for the American Kestrels.
You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. My name is Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm kind of Pat Schlarbaum's sidekick this morning.
And American kestrels are a favorite bird for roadside establishments of prairie. And we have Carl Kurtz with us. He is a prairie farmer from St. Anthony. Carl, could you tell us about your initial interest and kind of who you are?
I guess I grew up on a farm not far from Ames. And went to Iowa State in fish and wildlife biology, and then was introduced to prairie by a professor there named Roger Landers. My goal as the farmer naturalist was to bring back habitat, and I could see that the best, some of the very best habitat was a prairie for all kinds of wildlife species. And that's what really motivated me. And the diversity is important for a diversity of wildlife. Mm-hmm. So if you want to have small mammals and big mammals and birds such as the kestrel and hawks and owls and foxes, mm-hmm. now, of course, and coyotes, all of those things are part of the prairie and the best habitat for the biggest numbers, let's put it that way.
It's part of our heritage?
What did they say? It was 85% of Iowa was the prairie. The prairie built the soil, which we're farming today, and we should appreciate it for that standpoint, that it made the topsoil.
And one thing you've always been good to point out about the soil, tilth of prairie, as it acts as a sponge, acts as a filter?
Well, the prairie opens up the soil and makes it more porous and able to hold a lot more water. I think farming tends to compact the soil. No matter how you do it, you're going to get compaction. And of course, when there was prairie, there was virtually no stream pollution, no runoff, because it held the soil in place. The sod did, of course.
Carl, you've converted some of your agricultural lands to growing prairie.
I guess we have about 250 acres altogether, and about 150 of that is actually in prairie grassland of some form.
And you've been very instrumental with the Iowa Prairie Network in assisting others in establishing their prairies.
I guess that would be the goal, is to try to encourage other people to do it, try to help them understand the importance of it and what its use is. Even in agriculture, it has tremendous potential to solve agricultural problems through the use of buffers and wetlands. And
buffers, could you describe for our listeners that term? Buffers along our streamways?
The buffers would be like stream buffers. Mm-hmm. These would be borders along streams, which slow the water down before it gets to the stream. It may cause the silt to be deposited in there.
So the wider the border, the better. But what would be standard? What do you like to see with the waterways in
Iowa? I really
don't
know what the actual standard is. But, 100 feet or so certainly helps a lot. Probably more than that would be better. Yeah. But again, trying to maintain our farm economy, which is important, and I'm not trying to do away with that, but to try to deal with the issues that are being talked about with water quality and soil loss.
And habitat creation.
Yes, and then having habitat where there, in many parts of the state, there's almost no habitat at all left.
Yeah. And by habitat, you mean?
I'm talking about wildlife habitat for nesting birds. We've seen the pheasant population really plummet. Part of that's due to very poor spring weather conditions, of course, poor breeding conditions, but also if there's no habitat that's not disturbed for nesting. We have a very low amount of hay cover, which is not the best habitat, but certainly it did provide some habitat for birds.
Yeah, you mentioned the rough, cold, wet springs we've had, essentially five in a row, way above average. And those little chicks, after hatching, cannot tolerate.
Well, especially not things like last year when it snowed in May, and of course was probably in the 20s, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes it pretty hard on those grassland nesting birds like pheasants or Hungarian partridge or eastern meadowlarks. Mm-hmm. But the habitat can really improve their survival chances, and also it grows a lot of insects.
Carl, you also mentioned that the wetlands support agriculture. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Well, basically, we know that if you drain ag water into wetlands, it will process the nutrients. There's pretty good research behind that, that if you just hold the water, you can get rid of some of the nitrates. If your wetland's full of cattails, which it will be, they will process the nutrients, and so you're going to get cleaner water.
What does that mean, process the nutrients?
They're going to utilize those nutrients, the nitrates that are in the water. If you drain that water off eventually, it will not be there. And, of course, we're hearing about the dead zone in the Gulf, of course, which is because primarily of nitrates.
Yeah, in Iowa, where the dead zone is initiated, is not something we want to fly in our highest in our banner.
For those of us who are more lay people, the word nutrient is a confusing word because it sounds like a good thing, and you're saying you're trying to get rid of it. So can you just elaborate a little bit what that language actually means?
Well, certainly nutrients are a good thing. You know, that's why we get high yields on corn, but it's the fact that it eventually, if there's too much, if it's not all utilized and it washes out of the soil, then of course it goes into the water supply.
So you're really referring to fertilizer.
Right. So we need the nutrients, but how can we deal with the excess nutrients?
So Carl, as you inspire our listeners to engage the prairies, to visit our Doolittle Prairie Preserve, Ada Hayden, a lot of the work that the Story County Conservation Board is providing, that prairie habitat that I'm sure you were involved with the last 30 and 40 years. Could you give our listeners some of the basic how-tos of establishing prairie or weaving prairie into their own backyards?
Well, okay, so prairie, first of all, is a perennial plant community or a perennial polyculture. So it's a diversity of species, probably 95% of which, or maybe 98%, are perennial. A few are annuals, a few are biennials.
What would be an annual prairie species?
So let's say like partridge pea is an annual. Black-eyed Susan would be a biennial. Okay. But there really aren't very many. Most things are perennial.
They're here forever.
Right. So they're growing off of their root systems consistently year after year. Mm-hmm. They often get bigger. They may not flower the first years. So that's one of the things you have to remember if you're going to plant a little prairie of any kind, is that you're not going to get instant results. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to wait a couple years before it starts to flower.
So once people feel like they would like to make that commitment of 2 or 3 years to establishing prairie in their backyard, how would you prepare the seedbed? If there are listeners that would have been thinking about this, and maybe we can inspire to...
If it's a big prairie, you know, you often just plant in field stubble. But if it's in your garden or your backyard, I would say you want to remove the existing vegetation somehow, the perennial grasses that might be there, like bluegrass. You could till it up lightly, and then you could plant it. You could plant it in the fall if you were ready, or you could plant it in the winter, or you could plant it in the spring. And then you'd need to keep it, more than likely keep it mowed to help those plants get started. They're going to be tiny until probably the end of spring.
So the mowing essentially minimizes the sunlight for the annuals that you're trying to kind of not promote.
Well, you're going to try to control annuals, right, and you're going to try to help those tiny perennials get started. Unless you've got a really small bed, and then you could plant plants. You know, you could put in plugs of plants. You'd know what you had right away.
And yeah, that's kind of another chapter. I'd like to help people understand that there are some requirements, but it's all doable. We can connect to our prairie heritage. You mentioned the flowers. in the backyards. I know people are really taken by butterfly milkweed, for instance. What a robust, beautiful hue of red, a reddish-orange, just a bright plant. And of course, we all realize that anything with to do with butterflies has got to be a good thing.
A good thing, right.
Yeah. And so you mentioned that there's ways to establish prairie with seeding, and you mentioned planting in the spring or in the summer or in the fall. In the fall, is it, and leaving that seed throughout the winter, I understand the snow and freezing and thawing kind of compacts those seeds next to the soil particles. So there's a good proximity. It's really tight. If you planted in the spring, would you want to try to simulate that compaction to get the seeds right there with the soil?
You might, but generally a rain, even like we had last night, is going to pretty much
hard rain like that.
It's pretty much going to compact it okay.
Okay.
Mostly people would roll fields or compact them if it's large fields to prevent erosion. That's the main problem. You know, if you have really loose tilled soil and you roll it, you can really, really stop erosion from
that
heavy
rolling,
rains.
That's a compactor, a heavy implement.
Right,
that
right.
Really makes. I've seen a lot of prairie plantings where you can see the initial sprouts coming in the tractor tires,
right.
in the pattern,
right.
Where that it was just that compaction added that little benefit of.
The one reason I think for planting in the fall, the best reason might be that some seeds need what's called cold, wet. Stratification. So they need to be below freezing for more than 30 days in order to germinate. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, they may not come up for another year. They may just sit there and wait. So the prairie kind of comes up when it's good and ready. Not necessarily when you're ready, but when it's ready.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So if I tilled up my yard this spring and planted seeds, would I get something this summer?
Sure, you should get something probably by the end of June, you should start to see stuff coming up.
And you mentioned the mowing. How high would you try to mow?
The best plantings I've ever seen were the ones where they mowed them the shortest, like a couple inches.
Oh, okay.
For maybe a couple of months.
Every week or so, just make sure that...
Just keep it pretty short.
Yeah.
You can't hardly mow it too much early on. Then by the end of the summer, maybe have it up to 6 or 8 inches.
You were mowing the annuals to give light to the perennials. So are you saying that annuals tend to be big, tall plants really fast?
No, I'm saying the annuals tend to be the invasive species. These are the non-native things that are everywhere. Things like foxtail... Velvet leaf or buttonweed, lamb's quarter.
That's
yeah,
one
there's so many annuals here that are not native species, and if you don't mow a field, they could be 6 or 7 foot tall by the end of summer, and they would take up the moisture, the sunlight, and they would really inhibit what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. What is your best advice for the listeners if they have an interest?
Start small.
Okay, start small.
Just start small. And try to learn something from every phase, and then you'll have a good time.
Yeah.
Don't expect it to look like a native prairie overnight. Be patient.
We actually have another guest here in the studio with us as well. Pat, you want to introduce our other guest?
Yes, this is very exciting that I met Lauren Sullivan with the Liberal Arts and Sciences College here at Iowa State. Her work is in prairie also. But it includes other colleges, other disciplines. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning.
Well, I understand you're from Michigan. Maybe give us a little background on what brings you to Iowa.
Yeah, I'm from Michigan, and when I was looking for a graduate program, I saw Iowa State. I met my advisor, and I decided this was a good place for me.
And who is your advisor?
Stan Harpel.
Uh-huh.
And what department are you in?
We're in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Organismal Biology.
So you saw an announcement to engage a prairie project here at Iowa State.
Yes. I started with my advisor, and restoration and prairie ecology was something I was really interested in. And so a group of graduate students, myself and Brent Mortensen and Elizabeth Bach, decided we were going to try to do a restoration ecology experiment. And so we ended up finding a spot and planting a prairie, all in similar fashion to what Carl described, actually.
Uh-huh. And where's the spot at?
So we're on Ontario and Shoal Road, right south of Reactor Woods.
People are interested, they can stop by and see your prairie creation and your research there.
Oh, yes. We welcome anyone who stops by. We meet all sorts of people from the neighborhoods, and we really enjoy talking to people about prairie research, what we're doing, what's going on. So we really enjoy that.
And how'd it go when you were planting? Did you get any assistance?
Yeah. Part of this project, we got funding for the project to do conservation, to involve different audiences. And some of our audiences were, we decided to work with creative people outside of biology. So we actually planted the prairie with the help of a bunch of English 150 students. So they're a bunch of first year or introduction to English students. So hardly any of them had biology degrees. And so we got all the students out and they helped us seed. And it was really a really fun time.
Well, and your research is also devoted towards the mammals?
Yeah. So our research is a combination of the interests of the three of us graduate students, because we wanted to make it work for all of us. And so what we're doing is looking at how herbivores, the mammals, including deer, rabbits, voles, good kestrel food, and mice, how they influence prairie restoration.
Are you in your second year?
This is actually my fifth year.
Oh.
So are you introducing mammals to the prairie area, or you're just waiting to see if they show up? How does that work?
Yeah, so, and I should say this is the second year of the restoration, fifth year of, since I've been in Iowa. But, yeah, so the mammals just started to show up. I mean, it was a cornfield before, so there were probably some mice, but we've been tracking their abundances over time, and so we've been tracking the mammals, and we've seen definitely increases in population size. We've also been looking at other types of animals, like snakes, and following them through time, and so we've seen an increase in snakes. We've seen a lot of animals coming into our prairie.
So, but you're letting it happen naturally. You're not introducing anything.
Nope, they're all coming back.
And how do you do that? How do you keep track of them?
We set out just little Sherman traps. They're just little, you know, no-kill traps, and put them all over the site, and we fill them with food, and they come in the morning, and we, you know, or during the night, and then we just see who is there, and then release them.
Yeah, and the Sherman traps are the
what we live in a weird place. Yeah.
There's these little, what have little I got boxes. Myself into? It's kind of like a little live trap.
Yeah, exactly.
The Sherman trap,
exactly.
And a real key piece of equipment for prairie land researchers. Mm-hmm. It sounds like, and there's also a landscape design.
Yes. So we've actually had this really awesome snowball effect where we started working with the English students, you know, people in the program of the Master of Fine Arts that work with the environment, environmental writing. But then that sort of has inspired us to meet new people, a bunch of people in the College of Design, landscape architecture program. We've worked with students to help design a park around this prairie so we can, it can become basically a research and education park. So students can come, or anyone can come and see not only what we're doing with the research, but also what prairie means for Iowa, what it means for them. We're really trying to incorporate a creative component to our work.
And so often our wildlife work is pretty structured towards around the biology of the critters. And I think that's what I was mostly taken by, your outreach and inspiring other Iowans, other classmates to embrace the prairie and learn about what the prairie can bring back to our lives. Enhances the quality of all our lives.
Yeah, we've had a lot of comments because most of the people, like I said, that we work with outside of our program are not biology majors. They don't really do much with biology. They don't even really go outside all that much to appreciate nature. And so they've all really enjoyed it and have really had good things to say.
What kind of comments have they said?
Just they used to go out to see prairies as students in Iowa, because a lot of students in Iowa, you know, in middle schools and early high school go to prairies and experience that. But, you know, they hadn't really been to one since then, and they have really enjoyed getting back, spending time outside.
Lauren, I'm curious, what for you is the most interesting part of this? What's meant the most to you?
I mean, I obviously love the science. That's why I'm in graduate school. But it's been great to have an opportunity that most graduate students don't get to work with people in different programs and express your creative side. I think that sometimes our work doesn't reach as many people because, you know, scientific graphs aren't always as easily accessible as maybe a painting of the prairie as it progresses through time, or creative writings about how this landscape is changing. And so I think that that's a good way to reach a lot of people. And so, I mean, I've been really fortunate to have this experience.
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful principle there. We like to think of you as a multiplier effect, because your interest is being spread to all these other individuals, where so often prairie people just essentially kind of talk to prairie people.
Yeah, we've worked with almost 200 students now, most of them not biology students. So
Do you think it's really had an effect on them to be involved with the prairie? Do you think it's changed them in any way?
I hope so. A lot of them have shown interest in helping. A lot of them have come back to work with us. So I think that they're excited to be involved. And I mean, there were even stories of some of the English students who were very grumpy about having to seed at first. But really, by the end, once they realized what it was all about, they were able to come back and they were really excited about it and talking about fire and how they wanted to be a part of the burns and really just wanted to be involved. And these were students who had really no interest in it at first. So they've definitely.
And Carl, that kind of makes a nice segue into some of that maintenance that's necessary for your prairie plantings. The use of fire.
It's a really important tool. What we've seen by it is that it promotes the establishment of new plants in a dramatic fashion. Because many, many plants really respond to fire. It opens the area up, and we'll often see green seedlings everywhere after fire. So it really does move.
How many different species did you plant, Lauren?
We planted 54 species.
Have you documented all 54 at this stage? I would think that would be.
We have not seen all of them yet.
The seed is there.
The seed's there.
It's a coming thing.
Yep.
There's a necessary thing called duff, where the foxtails, some of the annuals, will provide a place for the fire to become established.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the fire?
Yeah, the fire, as Carl mentioned, is an essential component. But in the spring.
But what do you mean by
annuals,
the fire?
Yeah, in the spring, the annuals are kind of trying to dominate. And the fire will suppress those annuals. And it allows the sunlight to get down to those little prairie plants. So a project about a third or fourth year, you start thinking about, oh, it'd be nice to put a fire in here. And then, as Carl mentioned, some of the seeds are there ready to go. And then in the spring, there are cold season annuals, and they're from England quite often, and they do real well in Iowa. Whereas the prairies are more warm season. By introducing fire in April, you suppressed your annuals that are kind of competing with those prairie plants. Nutrients and sunlight is available for the prairie plants to go ahead and.
So what do you really mean by introducing fire?
Burning it.
Just burning the whole property?
Yeah.
And you're enhancing the perennials. I think that's what fire does, too. It enhances the perennials.
Thank you.
It really helps them to be bigger, to flower more. That's another major element.
And the flowers are what we're really striving for in our backyard landscaping. Well, let's take a little break. Thank you for all the sharings, and we'll be back after a little audio portion. The Blue Boat Home by Peter Mayer. This is an excerpt from a writing by John Madsen, a leading Iowa conservationist of the 20th century. Tallgrass prairie is a bittersweet thing. In deep winter, when the long winds blow out of the northwest, the prairie world can be as cold, hard, and cheerless as iron. A bitter place of wind-packed snow and of sere and broken stems, a colorless monotony of white, gray, and dun. Long ago, Washington Irving wrote, "To one unaccustomed to it, there is something inexpressibly lonely in the solitude of the prairie. The loneliness of a forest seems nothing to it." If the human emotion of loneliness can be defined as a bleak desolation of spirit, a sort of gray hopelessness unrelieved by any color or joy, then winter prairie is surely one of its embodiments. And then, suddenly, all that begins to change.
Sometime in the night, a spring Chinook begins to blow and the hard winter winds shift and soften. The annual prairie miracle is underway. The lonely time begins to pass. Company is coming. There is a rich, loamy sweetness to the air as the sun warms the deep prairie soils and life begins to emerge from winter hiding. So with that, I'd like to welcome a couple of the best friends an Iowa prairie could ever have, Carl Kurtz and Mike Metz.
Been listening to Peter Mayer, who's singing Blue Boat Home from his CD Earth Town Square. Peter Mayer will be performing at City Auditorium tomorrow, March 29th, Saturday, at 7:30. And you are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. My name is Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm kind of Pat Schlarbaum's sidekick this morning. Yeah. And Pat's talking about the prairie with some of his guests here.
Yes, Carl Kurtz is here. Carl is, some of our listeners may recognize his name, as quite a photographer, but he is in a prairie seed business as a farmer near St. Anthony. And Carl, let's talk about local ecotype. Could you kind of give us an idea if people hear that term?
So local ecotype of anything would be a plant that originated close to where you are or close to the site you live in. You know, in other words, wouldn't have to be right in your backyard, of course, but let's say within a few miles. So it would have evolved with the climate and the moisture conditions, you know, moisture, weather, and all that sort of thing, right where you are.
Uh-huh.
And the daylight period length and the change in seasons are a factor in that, you know.
So prairie seeds from Nebraska, southern Illinois would probably, they'll get started in Iowa, but probably won't.
Probably long term, you're going to lose them.
You're going to lose them long term.
The things from the west tend to grow up where it was drier. Some of the plants, if you got them from southern Missouri or southern Kansas, they likely, often those plants may go dormant in the summer because it's so hot down there. The ones from Minnesota would bloom at a different time period, so then they wouldn't be in tune with the insect populations that are here for pollination. So there's lots of factors involved in local
things to keep in mind.
Yes.
And we also know that a lot of our backyards are shaded, and we think of prairie kind of out in the full sun. But there is a term, I understand, called savanna.
Okay, so a savanna was probably the edge community in the prairie where it joined the woods. Often they had bur oaks, white oaks, and other trees that were very fire tolerant. They were probably pretty open, and some of that opening was maintained by grazing of elk and deer. And they were different plant communities, but had many of the same prairie species. But still they were different because some things were very shade tolerant.
You know, when you think of prairie in the kind of stereotypical form, you see a huge open land with just tall grasses. Would you say that Iowa in its natural form was more of a savanna type of environment where there was both trees and open land? Or what is Iowa naturally? I know it was a lot of swamp.
Well, I think it depends on the southern part of the state was probably savanna, and along the river valleys, most river valleys had a savanna edge, probably on the south side primarily, because that would be the sunny side. But I think much of it, there were areas that there were probably no trees in sight for miles, unless there was a stream that would stop the fire. So, you know, North Ames has some very nice savanna elements, as does the south side of Ames. You know, there's big old oaks.
And what are some of those diagnostic prairie plants of the savanna that you would kind of be indicative of that?
I'm trying to think. So the white gentian would be one that was kind of common in savannas.
White gentian?
There were lots of things that grew pretty well in both places, you know.
Okay.
And I actually don't know all those species very well because we don't have them.
Yeah.
But you could get a list pretty easily. But if you planted just a straight prairie, you'd probably see the things that didn't survive, you know, and the things that did.
And you mentioned prairie plants. We've talked about seeding. How about the prairie forbs, the flowering plants that you can buy as plugs?
Well, if you go to some of the major nurseries, well, probably like Ion Exchange, would have many, many species as plugs.
Yeah. And you could Google that, Ion Exchange.
You could get that easily.
How do you spell that?
Just I-O-N, capital I-O-N, Exchange. I mean, I know they have lots of plugs. And they would be pretty local ecotype, although they tend to be north of us a ways.
Well, Carl, your inspiration is quite important. And we understand we have a list. Lloyd Krim is ready to... Good morning, Lloyd.
Good morning, Pat.
Yeah, this is great. And I understand you do prairie hikes out at Doolittle Prairie Preserve. Could you tell us where that is located?
It's just kind of south of Story City. There's directions on the Story County's website for there.
Sure. So check out the websites. And you do these prairie hikes the fourth Thursday of every month?
Pretty much. This year in August, I'm doing it the third Thursday, but the rest of the times are the fourth Thursday. Start out here in May on the 22nd of May.
Okay. How many years have you done these prairie hikes, Lloyd?
I guess I'm starting about my 23rd year.
23rd year. And the listeners, I can also recommend that you never have the greater pleasure to follow an environmentalist through a prairie than Lloyd Krim. These are just fabulous opportunities to essentially see the prairie unfold from May. What's a prairie like in May?
Yeah, it's fairly short yet. There's a lot of flowers just coming up, a lot of the early flowers. So it's easy to walk around. You get to see a lot of ground, different places.
And then in June, the prairie's taller. Mm-hmm. What would be some of the plants you would and flowers you would hope to see in June?
Oh, it depends. It changes from year to year. Like every year is different, so there's different plants that come into flower earlier or later each year. I didn't bring my list of plants.
And possibly over 200 species at the Doolittle Prairie Preserve.
Yeah, not as extremely diverse as some places, but it's pretty good.
Lloyd, hi. This is Ursula. I'm here at KHOI with Pat. Could you explain to us a little bit what the Doolittle Prairie Preserve is?
Okay, it's a small section of land in the center, kind of in the center of the section. It's up way back off the gravel road, and it's an area that the Doolittles did not tile and they did not farm completely. The best section of the prairie is about, I guess, about 10 acres or so, and it was never plowed. They did take hay off of it every year. You know, it's not completely untouched, but the haying, it did not hurt the prairie, and so it's still pretty much as it was. It's probably one of the best representations in central Iowa of what the prairie might have used to look like.
There you go. That's our Story County heritage. Lloyd, thank you so much for doing these prairie hikes. And it was May
22nd.
May 22nd, Thursday night at Doolittle Prairie.
If someone wants to find out your schedule of hike, where would they go to get that information?
The Story County Conservation publishes it in the paper, and the dates are May 22nd, June 26th, July 24th, and August 21st.
Okay.
That's just great. Well, Lauren, is there any other announcements you'd like to make?
Yeah, speaking of community involvement. So if you're interested in hearing what we do at Oak Ridge Research and Education Prairie, that's the prairie I was talking about that we're working on. Or just generally, you know, if you have questions, you want to get involved, we're going to have a meeting on April 19th at 10 o'clock in the Applied Sciences Building, Applied Sciences 2 on Iowa State campus. If you want to find out information, you can go to our Facebook page at Oak Ridge Research and Education Prairie.
Thank you. And all of the information that we've been giving today we'll put on our website as well so that you, the listener, can find some of this good stuff.
Thank you so much, Carl, for coming by.
You're welcome.
Nice
to be here.
Any last words, Carl?
Most people would say, I just wished I'd done this 10 or 15 years sooner.
That's nice. Well, to round out the show, let's hear from KHOI reporter Becca Brown, who is also our faithful engineer. Hi, Becca. Becca is producing an ongoing series on traveling Iowans, where she talks with people who are infected with the wanderlust. Let's listen to three short interviews, which are about trips within the faith communities to do service work. And Rebecca went to three churches located here in Ames, the Collegiate United Methodist Wesley Foundation, Collegiate Presbyterian Church, and St. Thomas Aquinas Church and Catholic Center. And let's listen to what they had to say.
Aaron, and I am the Christian Education Director here at Collegiate United Methodist Church and Wesley Foundation.
Awesome. All right, what are some of the places that Collegiate Wesley Foundation goes to for trips?
Well, we are very excited this summer to have three different mission trips planned. We have a trip for the middle school kids, and we'll be working with many organizations in the Twin Cities up in Minneapolis. And we'll be working with some children, doing some yard work for a shelter, and hopefully packaging food like the Meals for the Heartland program. So we'll keep busy there. We have a senior high trip planned to Cedar Rapids. Believe it or not, there's still flood relief happening in Cedar Rapids, even these many years after the flood happened. So we feel it's important to learn about our neighbors in our area also. So we're excited about that. And the next trip of the summer will be a intergenerational trip to Costa Rica. So many of us have never been out of the country before, and many have not even done a mission trip who are on this trip. So this is going to be a great learning experience for all of us.
What are some of the things that everyone learns while on their trip?
Well, I hope, this is my opinion, I hope that we can learn that our faith is a way to show others the love of God. And one way we can do that is to help people who need special care and to learn to be in solidarity with people who might not have a voice or who might need some extra attention.
What do you hope they're going to bring back to Ames?
I hope that the things that they can bring back is more compassion for people who are in need, and maybe even ideas to do work here or to, as especially our high schoolers graduate and go to other places, to be able to take these experiences with them and show others how to help people also.
What about the older community? Because it's, you know, you think of always teaching the younger community how to, you know, be compassionate. But do you think there's a difference between what the younger community and what the older community will learn? Like you said, Costa Rica is going on an intergenerational trip. So.
That's very true. And I suppose I would hope that the older folks would be nudged to learn some of the same things that the younger kids would, realizing that sometimes when you're older and you might be in a different place in your life, you might be able to affect change differently. If nothing else, most of our older folks can vote. We have a voice just by being an older set. Although there are some middle schooler and high schoolers going on this Costa Rica trip also. So I hope we can figure out a way to even communicate between the generations better, which I think is important.
Indeed. Any final words to the community?
I know it seems weird to take, especially older folks, to take vacation time to go on a trip where you basically work. And I have a hard time articulating how cool it is to be able to do that. It sounds like it's something, well, why would you want to do that? But really, something magical happens on these trips that you get to connect with people that you would never probably connect with in your life otherwise. And you get to just experience a different type of being in the world. And it's hard to put words to that feeling. So I hope everybody gets a chance to do a mission trip someday.
Awesome. Well, thank you for speaking about traveling with your church.
No problem.
My name is Betsy Thompson, and I'm the Children and Youth Pastor at Collegiate Presbyterian Church.
What are some of the places that parishioners go to for a mission trip?
We send our youth on a yearly mission trip. This year they went to Denver. We've sent them to Appalachia. We've sent them to Louisville, St. Louis, Minneapolis, all over.
And what are they doing on these trips?
various things at various locations. This year, they worked with social service agencies and food banks and clothing banks and general areas like that. In Appalachia, they built and rehabbed homes. In Arkansas, they worked at a children's home.
And what are kids learning on these trips?
They're learning that life is very different for some people. They're getting a whole new perspective. They learn a lot about poverty and about how privileged they really are.
What do you think is some typical reaction that kids come back with? You know, what did they say that they learned from these trips?
I think youth are really shocked and surprised about how so many Americans have to live. I think they come back very thankful and grateful for the lives they have. And I think they really have a desire to work towards changing some of the systems that are in place so that people can lead better lives.
Do kids go on to do more things in their community? Do they get more involved with various organizations?
A lot of our kids, maybe after or in conjunction with just because of who they are, work with Chef at the high school, which is an outreach group. And then a lot of them also go on the trip to Africa where they build schools their junior and senior year. And so a lot of our kids do that sort of stuff with the school district as well.
And what do you hope they bring back to Story County from these exciting adventures?
I hope they bring their stories back and talk to their friends and talk to the people in the congregation. And I hope they bring the desire to change and to be part of that change in the community.
Any last words for the Ames community and for Story County?
If you have an opportunity to travel with a group, to travel by yourself, to do any sort of mission work to get outside of your comfort zone, I encourage you to do it. It's life-changing.
This is Sherry Riley. I'm the Coordinator of Social Justice and Director of Campus Ministry at St. Thomas Aquinas Church and Catholic Student Center here in Ames.
What are some of the places that parishioners get to go to at St. Thomas?
We have a number of trips normally throughout the year. We've done trips to Honduras to visit our sister parish. Unfortunately, that's no longer it's something that we are able to do because we have a travel warning in Honduras. It's really kind of hampering our efforts there. But we do still have our sister parish relationship there, so we're hoping that they'll actually come to see us in October. This year had spring break trips. We did a monastic plunge, which is a little unusual because it's more of a contemplative style of a trip, not a service-oriented trip. And then we did our long-standing relationship with Williamsburg, Kentucky. We traveled down, sent 13 students to do a lot of home rehab and repair type projects. So that's a very service-oriented trip.
What are some of the things that they are learning on these trips?
Well, you know, oftentimes, especially when it's their first trip, one of the things that they want to do is just go help people. And what they learn is that, you know, yeah, maybe you go and you build a handicap ramp or you fix a roof, but it's a lot less about helping people and it's a lot more about learning to love people, learning to know and love people who are in a different situation than you are. You know, the help you bring is really peripheral to the camaraderie that's built, the relationships that are built. And so maybe you help, maybe you don't, because those things could be done there and by people there. But what you do is learn to love and know an other.
So what are some other things other than love that parishioners bring back to Ames or Story County?
Well, we've done trips in a variety of places in the past. So, for instance, when we went to a Native American reservation in Arizona, one of the things that I expected people to learn was that Native Americans are really not very different from us, and yet then they are. Their history, their culture is very different. So learning how to appreciate them in their own culture and see that their differences do not make them outsiders, but make you the outsider. And so you learn to have a greater appreciation for people in different cultures, especially if all you've ever known is rural Iowa or even urban Iowa. If you've grown up mostly in Iowa or in the Midwest, taking yourself to a mountain culture or to a Native American culture or to a mountain culture in Honduras is going to be so different than rural Iowa. So different. And yet people there are happy and people there have wonderful lives and fulfilling lives just as we do here.
How would you encourage non-religious people to take mission trips or the idea of a mission trip?
Well, I think if you look at it in terms of service, I mean, everybody wants to do service. I mean, this generation of young people are raised to thrive in service to one another and to others. It's pretty easy to encourage people to go on service trips. The university has Breakers trips, and they do a lot of Habitat for Humanity projects and things like that. And you get to see right up front the family that you're working with, the family who's going to own that home when you're done building it, and how it's going to change their lives to have the stability of a home.
Any last words for the Story County community?
Yeah, there's this temptation in the world, and we've been hearing more and more about it. It's almost called poverty tourism. And we have to be really careful that we don't engage in poverty tourism. We're not going just to see the poor and help them this week, this moment, and then feel good about ourselves when we get home. If we take a trip like this, it's because we want to enter into the lives of other people and really be transformed ourselves. We're not building a ramp or building a building, creating a latrine, doing a water project. It's not going to transform that community so dramatically. Hopefully it's we ourselves who are transformed.
Well, thank you, Sherry, for your time.
You're so welcome.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and that was Rebecca Brown speaking with three Ames churches about traveling to do service. I've been your host today, Pat Schlarbaum, together with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Our guests today here in the studio have been Carl Kurtz and Lauren Sullivan, and called in Lloyd Krim.
Music we heard was Blue Boat Home by Peter Mayer from his CD Earth Town Square. Peter Mayer will be performing at City Auditorium tomorrow, March 29th, Saturday evening at 7:30. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley. And we also heard Smoothie by Nickel Creek during Rebecca's segment. Local Talk is engineered, as always, by our trusty Rebecca Brown.
You can also listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where you'll find an archive for all of the Local Talk shows we produced since we first went on the air in 2012 at our website. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. There you find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our shows.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families that donate $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, although we appreciate whatever fits into your budget. And we would like to hear your feedback either by phone at 292-2878, that's 292-2878, or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or at the email khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio. Mm-hmm.